This week on Behind the Lens. A new report finds the city of New Orleans should get at least $12 million more each year from hotel taxes. In education news, the Orleans Parish School District took over failing Harney Academy. Now the district may not be able to spend thousands in federal money earmarked for the school. And a newsmaker interview with a Mosaic Fertilizers official about a potential environmental disaster in St. James Parish.
We are actively moving to assure that should a failure occur, and I personally believe that's unlikely, but should a failure occur, that we will be able to contain it on site.
We'll have an update from gypsum stack number 4 at Mosaic's Uncle Sam plant. I'm Tom Wright. You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens.
Brought to you by community support. Learn more at support.thelensnola.org.
A new report by the Bureau of Governmental Research finds a lack of accountability and transparency when it comes to New Orleans hotel tax revenue. The nonprofit's report could give a boost to Mayor LaToya Cantrell as she seeks more city funding from tourism revenue. Michael Isaac Stein reports.
The report focuses on the 16.35% tax that's added to hotel room bills. And this tax brings in a significant amount of money to the city, roughly $200 million a year, which is equivalent to about one-sixth of the total local revenue produced in Orleans Parish. And what the report focuses on is the amount of that money that actually goes back to the city of New Orleans for general services. So as of now, that's a pretty small amount, roughly 10%. The huge bulk of this money, 75% of it, goes back into tourism, specifically to fund 4 tourism-related entities, including the Convention Center and Stadium District, as well as New Orleans and Company. And what the study, what the report concludes is that the city should, in fact, be getting a larger chunk of this money, at least 1% more. And they say that could be, you know, done through either raising new taxes or just reallocating some of the existing tax back to the city, again, just for general services such as water management or public safety, but not necessarily pegged towards tourism. You know, one of the arguments in the report is that these things are vital for tourism as well. You know, if you can't keep the city dry, if you can't keep it safe, that's going to affect tourism itself. That argument is that the city should be getting more of this money. The other major conclusion from the report was that these taxes in all, there's just a lack of accountability and transparency when it comes to these taxes. So this one quote, I think, you know, pretty well summarizes the complexity of these laws. They say, "There are a total of 16 hotel tax levies that are divided and in some cases subdivided into 29 revenue shares that go to a dozen different public and private entities and purposes." They also note that there are 15 separate acts that govern how the convention center can use hotel tax revenue, and that those acts haven't been codified into a single document, meaning that if you want to understand how the convention center uses this money, you need to look at all 15 different acts and try and make sense of it. Basically, they're just saying that this isn't easy to understand from a citizen standpoint. And the other issue they raise is one of accountability. So 15 out of 16 of these, you know, hotel tax levies, they're either permanent or set for an indefinite period, meaning that they don't come up for, you know, incremental reviews to make sure they're still appropriate doing what they're supposed to do.
Okay, what's been some of the reaction so far from the tourism industry?
We did get an initial statement from the president of New Orleans and Company, Stephen Perry. Basically, he said that an increase, a 1% increase to the hotel tax just wouldn't work for the tourism industry, that it would make hotels, you know, it would hurt their competitiveness with other cities. He cited a elasticity analysis, although we haven't seen that or know what that analysis contains. But yeah, he says that 1% more to the city is just simply not workable for the tourism industry.
All right, Michael Isaac Stein. Michael, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
The Orleans Parish School District faces a $430,000 shortfall at Edgar Harney Elementary School. The district forced its former charter operator to return the school to district control in the middle of the school year. Education reporter Marta Jusen explains what's happening.
Harney was actually its own school district, so when it closed in January, that meant all of its federal funding went back to the state. Even though the district wants that to run the school, the state can't just transfer money like that mid-year.
Oh, I do want to get a sense of impact here. I mean, $430,000 is a heck of a lot of money. Our current operation still is Harney still open is what I'm trying to ask.
Harney's still up and running at the moment. They do have state funding. The per pupil funding is coming in. What is not coming in is the federal funding that was allotted to the charter school as its own district.
What are the district and state trying to do now about that shortfall?
They're still trying to work together. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a policy shift that would allow this money to follow kids for other circumstances when the district takes over a charter school.
Does this impact the district's ability to act as a watchdog over all of these separate charter systems that they are taking over?
It certainly presents an interesting scenario where a takeover would cost the district money. So I think that's why I believe that the state and the district are probably looking to ratify this fix this as quickly as possible, because at the moment it's a $330,000 liability for the district.
Marta Jusen on the Education Beat, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In St. James Parish, environmental authorities and local residents are waiting to see if a fertilizer manufacturer there can head off a potential catastrophe. It was late January when state officials warned that part of a 200-foot-tall stack of gypsum waste was at risk of collapse. That stack holds millions of gallons of toxic wastewater, and if its north wall fails, that water could drench nearby wetlands. It could even flow down the nearby Blind River into Lake Maurepas. We spoke Friday morning with David Jellerson. He is Senior Director of Gypsum Engineering for the manufacturer, Mosaic Fertilizers.
We are still detecting lateral motion of the stack at both the crest and the perimeter dike at the base. It does appear that the rate of movement is slightly slowing as we remove water from the stack. But we have not reached the point where it has stopped moving.
Any further idea of what's causing that shift of the earth under that wall?
No, I mean, and at this point, I think it'll take us a bit of time to really understand the nature. The zone of movement from the data we have appears to be some 95 feet or so feet below the natural ground. So we put some instruments in there, and that's where we detected this movement.
Okay.
So it's sliding on some geological event that has caused, you know, the clay layers to slip. This is a very slow movement, so we're detecting, you know, I think in the range of a half inch or maybe a little bit less than a half inch to, in some areas, and some day, it varies day to day on the measurements. That's perhaps some variability in just the survey accuracy, but half inch to, you know, maybe 3/4 of an inch.
What are you doing to prevent a potential breach of that northern wall?
And so the primary thing that we're doing is removing water from the pond that's on top of that stack or in that stack, and that removes the driving force for the motion. In addition to that, there are some ditches that collects seepage from the stack along the side slopes, and we've deepened those to draw the water level down even further. And then at the base, we've begun work to construct a what we call a stability berm up against that perimeter dike.
Mr. Jellison, what is actually produced at the Uncle Sam plant?
So the Uncle Sam plant processes phosphate rock, which is an ore that comes from phosphate rock mines, and converts it into a water-soluble phosphoric acid.
Okay.
As a process for the manufacturer of fertilizer.
So the fertilizer itself is not actually produced there, but the phosphoric acid is produced there. Okay.
Correct. Then the acid is sent off-site to a facility that manufactures fertilizer.
Okay.
The facility there in Louisiana is situated primarily that it can take advantage of supply chain routes, you know, barge routes up the Mississippi River.
How does the water play into that production process?
So the water is used in the manufacturing facility generates a lot of heat. In fact, much of that heat is captured to provide electric power. So we generate our own electricity on site. But that heat then has to be cooled. The systems have to be cooled. So we use this process water in the plant operations for both the operational considerations and for cooling of the plant.
And how much water right now is sitting in that reservoir at stack number 4?
Oh, we've been pulling some off, but it's in the neighborhood of 700 million gallons.
How quickly are you able to pull that off the stack?
Right now, we're moving it off at a rate of a little over 10 million gallons a day. We'll have another line operational today that should nearly double that rate.
It seems from the aerial imagery I've seen that the reservoir at number 4 seems to be the largest, but how many reservoirs in general do you have at that particular facility north of Convent?
When we first discovered this, we had two reservoirs that were actually had recently been constructed in preparation for moving the operation from stack 4 to a new stack area. Those two ponds were the first ones we filled, and that was in the order of 145, 150 million gallons. So that's the first water we moved off of the stack. Now we have another pond we call the 110-acre reservoir that we started flowing to this week. And that has the capacity of in the order of 300 million gallons. So that matches what the expectation is we should move off the stack to you know, increase the stability. But beyond that, we have another pond, which is completion of construction. It's a lined pond that will be complete in 6 to 8 weeks that has capacity of another half a billion gallons.
Okay. What's in that water?
So primarily, it's a weak solution of phosphoric acid. So because it's used in the manufacturing of phosphoric acid in the... It picks up portions of that. So it has a low pH. So it's a weak acid. So it has a pH, you know, maybe a little bit above 2. It contains high levels of phosphorus. There's been some question of radionuclides. It's been an issue that's been raised, and we've just submitted some analyses to the state. And if I recall not correctly, it had radium content of... 14, they call it picocuries per liter. I believe that the drinking water standard for radium is like 5. So it's not drinkable, but it's not, you know, it's like 3 times what would be acceptable for a drinking water source.
And does Mosaic do anything to treat that processed water before it goes into the reservoir?
No. No, it's just recirculated within the process. The facility ordinarily does not discharge process water. It just consumes it all internally. There's a bit more inventory on site now than ordinarily because of all the excess rain that's happened over the last year. We had a lot of rain, so in the facility subject, ordinarily more water evaporates than is used. You know, so you have to make up the system, but in periods of heavy rain, that's why we have the larger ponds, so you can accommodate, you know, the rainfall cycle.
Right. Well, how
the facility does have a deep well injection system where they can move water, runs through some filters, et cetera, and for injection for disposal.
Where do those injection well type systems actually put the water at that point?
Oh, they're very deep, over 7,000 feet.
How vulnerable are those phosphogypsum walls to extreme weather events such as storms, high winds, that sort of thing?
Well, contrary to, let's say, for an example, an earthen dam, which is subject to erosion, and we've seen, you know, over the nation and even elsewhere, you know, you see when they talk about dam failures, those are typically earthen dams. Gypsum is not very susceptible to erosion. And in fact, it's not uncommon in many places where they just run water down the sides because it's very hard, it doesn't erode. So on top of that, the gypsum stacks are operated with very wide top dikes. In this case, I think we were in the order of 40 feet across. And so you have inner dikes and outer dikes, so they're not very susceptible to wind-driven events. And then, of course, the operations plans all consider wave run-up analysis. You have waves that could be generated from high winds. And those are accommodated by creating greater freeboard. In other words, you keep the water low enough that would create a problem.
How does this compare to the New Wales incident, the sinkhole in Florida that was, I believe it was first reported in 2016?
That's correct. It's a completely different geology. So in Florida, they have what they call karst geology. So the failure that occurred there was, and you may read occasionally, there sinkholes occur in Florida. And those sinkholes are primarily caused what they call an erosion feature, where there's a thick confining unit in the geology that retards water movement. But occasionally there will be what the geologists would refer to an erosion channel that relieves water from the superficial aquifer down into the deeper aquifers. And as that water flow continues, it will start carrying sands and clays from the upper aquifer and upper soils until it reaches a point where the superficial soils can't support it and then it collapses, and it's referred to as a collapse sinkhole. So the mode of failure at the New Wales facility was such an event occurring underneath the stack, and when the collapse occurred of the superficial soils, and that was a lined stack, so it had a plastic liner and everything under it, but that's not structural. So when the collapse occurred, it compromised the liner, which allowed then the erosion to continue to the surface, and some of the water went down that hole, and of course, the company installed wells to recover it, and then had to seal that breach up. The soils at the Uncle Sam facility are clay soils to some great depth. So you don't have that in that area, that type of phenomena occurring. But in this case, it appears that, and of course this will require more investigation. It appears that this is more of a slipping of different layers of the deeper soil between each other. And there has been no release of processed water at the Uncle Sam facility as a result of this event that's occurring. And, you know, our intention is to keep it that way.
Mm-hmm. The company remains under a consent decree since 2015. EPA considered your company in violation of federal law. You disputed that over the course of a decade, and there is now this consent decree that governs, I believe it's $1.8 billion that you'll eventually be spending to take care of a lot of the waste products from not just the Uncle Sam plant, but other facilities in Florida and Louisiana. What do you say to residents and businesses in St. James Parish that that may have a lack of trust in what your company is doing with that particular process, and whether your company can prevent a potential catastrophe there?
So let me just address the $1.8 billion. So that $1.8 billion was a requirement that Mosaic establish the financial instruments and the financial and assure the financial guarantee that these facilities can be properly managed and ultimately properly closed at the end of their useful life. Prior to that, the company recognized their asset retirement obligations differently with corporate guarantees, et cetera. But for that settlement with the government, it basically established the fund to assure that it would be done, right? And from our perspective, it fully guarantees that those environmental liabilities, which really occur when the facilities close, that they're fully funded.
Again, I would ask, what would you tell your neighbors there in St. James Parish about how capable you are of preventing a potential catastrophe?
I would say I'm confident that we can. So we're in the process now of reducing the risk of a failure by moving the water off, building the stability berm that we anticipate will stop this movement. We are actively moving to assure that should a failure occur, and I personally believe that's unlikely, but should a failure occur, that we will be able to contain it on site. So we're physically looking at, there's a cane field to the north, which is Mosaic's property. It has stormwater ditches, and there's roadways along with culverts under it. So we're prepared in an event, if there were a catastrophic event, to plug those culverts on short notice. I mean, we are literally stockpiling dirt, getting plugs, et cetera. We're also making sure that we can manage the routine stormwater on site, working very closely with the Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality to look at all of the contingency risks that exist with the expectation and the intent that we can, in the worst case, that we can keep everything on the property. Obviously, in the best case, that we'll manage the water in the ponds we've identified, and then repair the issue.
You've got about 700 million gallons of water in the number 4 reservoir. What level would you like to see that water at after your pumping operations are complete?
The current approach is to move another 300 million gallons or so out of it.
So at a rate of 10 to 20 million gallons pumped a day or removed a day, what are we looking at, 3-4 weeks?
I'm projecting that we'll have the flow up closer to the 20 million gallons per day, so that will be, 15 days, 2 weeks.
Look forward to speaking with you closer to that time as well. Mr. Jellerson, thank you. Really appreciate your time.
Yeah, my pleasure.
That's all for this week. We'll have a new podcast next Friday afternoon. Hope you'll listen. And don't forget, your generous support makes our reporting possible. So please give a donation today at support.thelensnola.org. I'm Tom Wright. Thank you for getting Behind the Lens.